A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, I, J, K, L, M, N, O, P, Q, R, S, T. Hello and welcome to the latest podcast recording of P, Q, R, S, T. I am speaking quietly because the baby is finally asleep in the next room. And if I speak quietly enough, maybe I can do a podcast recording and he can have a nap. And both of us can accomplish our goals. So, yeah. Not much of a rant for you this time around, although I will say I continue to hate DirecTV, who once again sent me an envelope that looked like a card, birthday card or some such, turned out to be another ad for their service. And I would say a terrible service. I have no idea how good their service is. All I know is if they were the last TV service on Earth, I would get a lot of reading done, because I absolutely refuse to ever give them any money based on their deceptive advertising. Moving on, of course, in this episode of PQRST, we'll have the third half of the... There's a book and a Phantom Tollbooth recording. But I want to tell you about a couple things before we get to that I have experienced in the past week. It's the middle of June, and here in 2 weeks from yesterday, I get to go on stage at Comedy Works and do 5 minutes in the New Faces contest. And I have been working on my Hot Five since January. This will be the first time I've ever gotten up on stage at Comedy Works and done the same thing for a second time. It's always been something different. This time they will see more of what they got to see when I was on back in February, I think it was. And so, yeah, and I want to show the powers that be what I hope they're looking for. And I'm just believing that I'll give the best 5 minutes I have. And if that is good enough to advance, even more important to me, if that five is good enough to be considered for the B-list, then fantastic. But I'm going to give it what I got. And still doing about one open mic a week, although busy season is coming to an end. And so should be able to hit a little more than that. And I think one of the things I'd like to do is try to do two open mics when I do go out for a night, at least once a week do two. And Mondays, it looks like, might be the night for that, although Wednesday has some possibility as well. But last week, instead of doing an actual open mic, I did something that certainly was good for comedy, but was not an open mic in any form. What it was, I went over to my church, Waterstone Community Church, and joined wonderful friend and big sister Elsa Wolf, and also several members, former members of the 5th and 6th grade room that Elsa and I work with every Sunday, and we did an audio recording. She had written a script. This is all for Vacation Bible School, which kicks off next week. She had written a script called Finding Mo, and a bit of a take on Finding Nemo, hence the title, and they needed voice actors. And there were four young ladies, the McCullough teens, who were there. There was a guy named Rick, I believe it was, and Elsa and myself. And then Hillary, who was there just to do the audio recording of what we were putting together. And so I knew that I would get to do a character voice. I had a feeling I might get to do a couple character voices. I ended up doing five of the voices in the script. And almost everybody had a couple voices that they did. And I may not have had the most voices at five. Elsa might have had five herself. But my five, let's see, I had Manny, the seahorse. He's from Boston, so he's a seahorse. And I tried to talk like this. And a couple of times during the recording, I would come up with a British accent. Ironically, even though the British accent really is the easiest for me, it's the one that I can just slip into pretty much whenever. In fact, I don't know if I've spoken about this on the podcast before, when I get really tired, it's almost, I find myself doing the English accent when I'm too tired to do my normal accent, which is odd. I really can't explain how that works, but when I really get exhausted, I start talking like this, and it's a sign to me that I need sleep badly. Wizard needs sleep badly. Anyway, despite the English accent being the easiest and the one I slip into most comfortably, that didn't come up at all. There was Manny the Seahorse, who was from Boston. There was, what was the crab's name? He may have just been Captain Crab. And I did Captain Crab as a pirate, and I'm going to have to do Captain Crab as a quieter pirate, because I don't want to wake up the wee one. And there was Sid, I believe it was Sid, who was a mollusk with a flatulence problem, which is the first time I've ever said that sentence. But I pulled out my surfer dude, Joff, and so Sid the mollusk was really from, you know, from the West Coast, you know? And he was pretty grooving, although, again, flatulence problem, he had to apologize a lot. And there was the eel, who was the bad guy, and he may not have had a name, or he may have a name, I can't remember, but I was kind of visualizing Michael Keaton in Beetlejuice, and I would do the eel, evil and also a little crazy. And again, I have to do this quietly, because there's a child asleep in the next room. And finally, there was a swordfish. I don't even remember the swordfish's name, but I do know that he was pretty easy to pull off. I would just go into my high register and also do this. And then you would have the swordfish. And he didn't feel very popular. In fact, you know, the other children weren't quite sure about him, but when he saved the day at the end of the story, then they realized that he had been a good guy after all. Anyway, so I had those five voices, and initially, when we kicked off the table read, I had, I think, three voices assigned, and I looked through the script, and I wasn't complaining, but it didn't feel like I had a lot of lines. So when we got to the part where the crab was, and Elsa wasn't quite sure she had a pirate voice, I jumped in, like, hey, I can do a pirate! And so I picked up the crab, and then suddenly, in day three, there was one scene where the crab was talking to Manny the Seahorse, and so I was basically arguing with myself, and then Manny the Seahorse left the scene, and the crab was talking to the eel, and again, I was talking to myself. And I'd like to say I pulled it off. I think I did. But I'm sorry there wasn't a video recording. Maybe I'm not sorry. I think I'm sorry because the other actors around the table pretty much just did the voices and did them just fine. I don't know that I can claim myself to be a method actor. I honestly don't claim to be that much of an actor of any stripe. But when I was doing the crab like I'm doing right now, even though nobody can see me, I had one eye almost shut, and I was clenching my fist and leaning into it, and when I would do the eel, I had all these hand motions, and my eyes got all big, and anyway, I get into it when I do a character, even when it's just voice acting. I play it out in my body. It's just what I need to do to get it out of my system, and, you know, as voice actors go, I'm sure there are people that do this for a living that if they heard this, or if they are listening to this, hey, how you doing, would find my performance laughable, probably, but we had a good time, and I think we got a good recording, and you will get to judge this recording, hopefully, gentle listener, because if possible, I've requested a copy of what we recorded, and I'll do a podcast episode on it in the future. You'll get to hear the whole darn thing, and judge for yourself what kind of voice actor I can be. So yeah, it was not, I did not get to do any of my Hot 5 jokes, but I got to practice some of my voices, and that's useful for comedy, because I use the voices every now and again. In fact, the Hot 5 that I'm doing, at least as it's currently written, I have a Wicked Witch of the West impression, I have a Gremlin impression, I do my German accent, briefly, when I talk about the formula Nazis, and so there's several impressions, several accents, even though I'm trying to make it fairly straight stand-up. Anyway, moving on, this past Monday, today is Thursday on Monday, I was going to do the Munchie mic, which is downtown off, I think it's off Larimer Street, and I parked near the Mercury Cafe, walked about six blocks to the Munchie mic, found out it was canceled, and walked six blocks back to my car, and I've grown as a comic, not only in stage presence and just willingness to do things like open mics. I've grown in that there was a time, and it's probably within the last year, where if I had gotten up, it's not the courage, it's more the determination, because open mics aren't a ton of fun, and there are lots of things I'd rather be doing, but they're getting to be more fun, which is interesting, I didn't expect it. If I'd gotten up the chutzpah, shall we say, to do an open mic and gotten all the way to where it was, found out it was canceled, I would have considered that a sign from above to get myself home and do one of those other things that I could do. But instead, when I realized that, found out that the Munchie Mike was canceled, it was only about 7:13, and I knew that the sign up for the Goosetown Mike, the one at Goosetown Tavern, was open, and so I hustled myself back to the car, drove over to Goosetown, and got on that list. And I had deliberately not chosen Goosetown for my mic of the evening because a couple weeks ago I got signed up there and was next to last or third from last comic to get up, and there was no audience left at that point except the sound guy, the host, and the other comic waiting to get on. I guess I was second from last. And it's still valuable. As I've said here before, throwing jokes at an empty room, still, it's, you can hear whether or not they work better than if you're throwing them at your bathroom mirror or your car dashboard or whatever. So it's still valuable, but not fun. And so I'd heard the Munchie Mike had fewer participants and therefore better stage time. And this coming Monday, I'm going to try the Munchie Mike again and see if it's actually on this time. Maybe check with the website before I go down to see if there's information. But yeah, this coming Monday, whether or not I get to do the Munchie Mike, I think I'll do Goosetown again. I was not last this week. I was maybe fifth from last. And so arrived at 7:15, didn't actually get to get on stage until like 10:07. But it was still a good experience. Got to see a bunch of comics, and the waiting around while other comics are doing their stuff is not a ton of fun. But, you know, the more I get out there, the more I get known and, you know, meet people, see people that I know and see comics whose material I like. And admittedly, I mean, I don't want to... How do I want to say this? Everybody's doing... Well, I was going to say everyone's doing their own stuff. Not everybody's doing their own stuff. And if a comic's getting up and doing stuff he stole, he or she or whoever stole from some other comic, that sucks. But most comics, 99% of comics, are doing their own stuff, and I respect that. Most comics, especially in a bar setting, are doing stuff I don't particularly like. There was one comic... I mean, a lot of comics, if they're doing jokes about sex, jokes about drugs, jokes about rock and roll, I guess... just stuff that I don't particularly care for, that I would not buy albums, buy comics that are doing that kind of stuff. Dave Chappelle, for example. I have no desire to sit and watch Dave Chappelle for an hour. I'm sure he's funny. I can recognize the craft, but it's just not my kind of comedy. It's not stuff I find funny, and a lot of the comics are getting up and doing jokes I don't find funny, and some of them are doing stuff I find downright disturbing. For example, several of the comics Monday night were talking about smoking weed while driving, and how that's perfectly fine, and everybody should be laughing about it. And I'm sitting there thinking, being high while driving does not please me, a guy who gets out on a motorcycle and is putting his life in your hands. I have a problem with this, but I did not say anything, because they probably don't care what I think, and I, you know, didn't want to turn a crowd against me before I got a chance to get on stage. That's what stage time is for. Anyway, so the open mic experience, not always a ton of fun. Something like Solid Grounds is fun. I don't get to hear a lot of comedy besides my own, because Solid Grounds is mostly for music, but it's good people, and not that the comics at Goosetown are not good people, but people that have good things to talk about. There's scripture that says, you know, whatever is good, whatever is just, whatever is virtuous, whatever is excellent or praiseworthy, think on these things. And Solid Grounds is a very excellent and praiseworthy evening. Goosetown, not so much. Not at least from my point of view. But having said all of that, it's still the energy of people getting up on stage to tell jokes is fun. I've gotten over the sense of entitlement of like, okay, I was, you know, 20th on the list, and 33 comics have gotten up, and I haven't been called. What's going on? I didn't expect to be up until the end, and then only if, you know, I got the chance to. I was prepared if they said, okay, that was the last comic, we need to shut it down, sorry for those of you that didn't get a slot. I wasn't going to be happy with that, but I was prepared to accept it. And, you know, I wasn't second from last, I was like fifth from last. And the host, John Wilkins, says he gets to know me better, maybe I'll be up a little sooner. I also hope to, well, if Monday I get to do the Munchie Mike and then I shoot over to Goosetown, I may not be up any sooner, but maybe you know, maybe it'll be more of a case of, hey, I'm here and I'm going to put my name on the list, and oh, wow, I was two comics later, rather than, hey, I was here, put my name on the list, you know, fifth, and then waited for 2.5 hours. I don't know. He doesn't owe me anything. And it was good to have the stage time itself, the actual stage time itself. Have I talked about that? I have not. There were maybe a dozen people left, and you take away the host and the other four comics that were there waiting for their turn. It was maybe 6 or 7 people just there to listen. So a half dozen, you know, actual audience members by 10 o'clock at night, that's pretty good. And I made them laugh. I was doing, my wife really helped me out. Let me back up. Because it was Monday, I guess late last week, I wrote out the whole Hot 5 as I'm currently doing it, and I asked her to read through it and make suggestions. And she suggested a couple things, and she rewrote a couple jokes that she thought might improve. She even suggested bringing one back in that I had kind of abandoned. And so Monday night, I was trying to try out some of her ideas. And I got to try a couple of things. It's a 5-minute set that we're prepping, and I only did about 3 to 3.5 minutes, and so I didn't get to try everything. But a new joke I've come up with about Baby Spice, the Spice Girl, got a laugh. The Formula Nazi joke, which was new, got a laugh. And then there were jokes that have worked in the past that got nothing, like where I say that I had a hand in making Isaac. Well, not a hand exactly. Tiffany is wondering, you know, is it not a hand per se? If I'm saying per se and not exactly, that might be where I'm losing the laugh. I'm not sure, but it is annoying. I swear it's very annoying to do a joke you know can get a laugh and then it doesn't in a situation where people are willing to laugh. And I knew they were willing to laugh because I kicked off with, again, at my wife's suggestion, I brought the Frank Azar Field at Mile High joke back, since Sports Authority is bankrupt and the field is probably going to be sold, and so somebody's name's going to be up there. And hadn't thought that got the reception it deserved when I did it at Syntax, but she's like, I like that one, bring it back. And so I brought it back, and that got a laugh, got a good laugh. And so I knew, hey, there's an audience here who's willing to laugh if stuff is funny. And that's why I do it. It might be obvious and even ridiculous to say it, but, you know, it's so worth it. It was worth sitting for 2 hours, you know, waiting on other comics, some of whom got laughs and some of whom did not, for a chance, for my chance, to say, hey, see if I can make you laugh. And if I had gotten up an hour earlier when there were like 20 people in the room, maybe I wouldn't have gotten those laughs, or maybe I would have felt a little more intimidated. I certainly didn't feel intimidated. But open mics have just, they're a necessary evil, but I think I'm seeing more of the necessary and less of the evil. And so that's good, especially since busy season is coming to an end, and hopefully I can hit 2 or 3 or even 4 in a week, maybe 2 nights. And the other thing I want to do is look into open mics that are more musically based that might let me do some comedy in between parody songs. Because I want to have a regular opportunity on a stage, and the one that I'm thinking might be a thing, definitely there's a piano on that stage. And, yeah, there'll be more information on that, as I have some, because I have none right now. So hopefully the story of the voiceover recording and the open mic at Goosetown was some ways entertaining for you. And then if it wasn't, well, I have something that is almost guaranteed to be, because I was talking about voiceovers. And in recording the Phantom Tollbooth, it's all my own voice. And it's like 30 different versions of my own voice. So you get to hear a little more right now. I think, yes, Milo had gone to sleep and there was a meadow and there was stuff going on. And so anyway, we're going to find out if he wakes up. I certainly hope he does, or else this is going to be a very short podcast. So give me a second to get things spooled up, and we will hear the third part of the Phantom Tollbooth. Chapter 11, Discord and Din. One by one, the hours passed, and at exactly 5:22, by Tok's very accurate clock, Milo carefully opened one eye, and, in a moment, the other. Everything was still purple, dark blue and black, yet scarcely a minute remained to the long, quiet night.
He stretched lazily, rubbed his eyelids, scratched his head, and shivered once as a greeting to the early morning mist.
"I must wake Chroma for the sunrise," he said softly.
Then he suddenly wondered what it would be like to lead the orchestra and to color the whole world himself. The idea whirled through his thoughts until he quickly decided that since it couldn't be very difficult, and since they probably all knew what to do by themselves anyway, and since it did seem a shame to wake anyone so early, and since it might be his only chance to try, and since the musicians were already poised and ready, he would, but just for a little while. And so, as everyone slept peacefully on, Milo stood on tiptoes, raised his arms slowly in front of him, and made the slightest movement possible with the index finger of his right hand. It was now 5:23 a.m. As if understanding his signal perfectly, a single piccolo played a single note, and off in the east a solitary shaft of cool lemon light flicked across the sky. Milo smiled happily, and then cautiously crooked his finger again. This time two more piccolos and a flute joined in, and three more rays of light danced lightly into view. Then with both hands he made a great circular sweep in the air and watched with delight as all the musicians began to play at once. The cellos made the hills glow red, and the leaves and grass were tipped with a soft pale green as the violins began their song. Only the bass fiddles rested as the entire orchestra washed the forest in color. Milo was overjoyed because they were all playing for him and just the way they should.
"Won't Chroma be surprised?" he thought, signaling the musicians to stop. "I'll wake him now."
But, instead of stopping, they continued to play even louder than before, until each color became more brilliant than he thought possible. Milo shielded his eyes with one hand and waved the other desperately, but the colors continued to grow brighter and brighter and brighter until an even more curious thing began to happen. As Milo frantically conducted, the sky changed slowly from blue to tan and then to a rich magenta red. Flurries of light green snow began to fall, and the leaves on the trees and bushes turned a vivid orange. All the flowers suddenly appeared black, the grey rocks became a lovely soft chartreuse, and even peacefully sleeping Tuck changed from brown to a magnificent ultramarine. Nothing was the colour it should have been, and yet, the more he tried to straighten things out, the worse they became. "I wish I hadn't started," he thought unhappily, as a pale blue blackbird flew by. "There doesn't seem to be any way to stop them." He tried very hard to do everything just the way Chroma had done, but nothing worked. The musicians played on, faster and faster, and the purple sun raced quickly across the sky. In less than a minute it had set once more in the west, and then, without any pause, risen again in the east. The sky was now quite yellow, and the grass a charming shade of lavender. 7 times the sun rose and almost as quickly disappeared as the colors kept changing. In just a few minutes a whole week had gone by. At last the exhausted Milo, afraid to call for help and on the verge of tears, dropped his hands to his sides. The orchestra stopped. The colors disappeared, and once again it was night. The time was 5:27 a.m.
"Wake up, everybody! Time for the sunrise!"
he shouted with relief, and quickly jumped from the music stand.
"What a marvelous rest!" said Chroma, striding to the podium.
"I feel as though I'd slept for a week. My, my, I see we're a little late this morning. I'll have to cut my lunch hour short by 4 minutes."
He tapped for attention, and this time the dawn proceeded perfectly.
"You did a fine job," he said, patting Milo on the head. "Someday I'll let you conduct the orchestra yourself."
Tuck wagged his tail proudly, but Milo didn't say a word, and to this day no one knows of the lost week but the few people who happened to be awake at 5:23 on that very strange morning.
"We better be getting along," said Tuck,
whose alarm had begun to ring again,
"for there's still a long way to go."
Chroma nodded a fond goodbye as they all started back through the forest, and in honor of the visit he made all the wildflowers bloom in a breathtaking display.
"I'm sorry you can't stay longer," said Alec sadly. "There's so much more to see in the forest of sight, but I suppose there's a lot to see everywhere if you only keep your eyes open."
They walked for a while, all silent in their thoughts, until they reached the car and Alec drew a fine telescope from his shirt and handed it to Milo.
"Carry this with you on your journey," he said softly, "for there's much worth noticing that often escapes the eye. Through it you can see everything from the tender moss in a sidewalk crack to the glow of the farthest star. And, most important of all, you can see things as they really are, not just as they seem to be. It's my gift to you."
Milo placed the telescope carefully in the glove compartment and reached up to shake Alec by the hand. Then he stepped on the starter and, with his head full of strange new thoughts, drove out to the far end of the forest. The easy rolling countryside now stretched before them in a series of dips and rises that leaped up one side of each crest and slid gently down the other in a way that made stomachs laugh and faces frown. As they topped the brow of the highest hill, a deep valley appeared ahead. The road, finally making up its mind, plummeted down, as if anxious to renew acquaintance with the sparkling blue stream that flowed below. When they reached the floor of the valley, the wind grew stronger as it funneled through the rocks, and directly ahead, a bright-colored speck grew larger and larger.
"It looks like a wagon!" cried Milo excitedly.
"It is a wagon! A carnival wagon!"
seconded Tok. And that's exactly what it was, parked at the side of the road, painted bright red and looking quite deserted. On its side, in enormous white letters bordered in black, was the inscription, "Cacophonous A. Discord." And below, in slightly smaller black letters bordered in white, was, "Doctor of Dissonance."
"Perhaps if someone's at home, he might tell us how far we have to go," said Milo, parking next to the wagon.
He tiptoed timidly up the three wooden steps to the door, tapped lightly, and leaped back in fright, for the moment he knocked there was a terrible crash from inside the wagon that sounded as if a whole set of dishes had been dropped from the ceiling onto a hard stone floor. At the same time, the door flew open, and from the dark interior a hoarse voice inquired,
"Have you ever heard a whole set of dishes dropped from the ceiling onto a hard stone floor?"
Milo, who had tumbled back off the steps, sat up quickly, while Tok and the humbug rushed from the car to see what had happened.
"Well, have you?"
insisted the voice, which was so raspy that it made you want to clear your own throat.
"Not until just now,"
replied Milo, getting to his feet.
"Ah, I thought not,"
said the voice happily.
"Have you ever heard an ant wearing fur slippers walk across a thick wool carpet?"
And before they could answer, he went on in a strange, croaking way.
"Well, don't just stand there in the cold. Come in, come in. It's lucky you happened by. None of you looks well."
The faint glow of a ceiling lamp dimly illuminated the wagon as they cautiously stepped inside. Tok first, eager to defend against all dangers. Milo next, frightened but curious. And the humbug last, ready at any moment to run for his life.
"That's right. Now, let's have a look at you. Very bad, very bad. A serious case."
The dusty wagon was lined with shelves full of curious boxes and jars of a kind found in old apothecary shops. It looked as though it hadn't been swept out in years. Bits and pieces of equipment lay strewn all over the floor, and at the rear was a heavy wooden table covered with books, bottles, and bric-a-brac.
"Have you ever heard a blindfolded octopus unwrap a cellophane-covered bathtub?"
he inquired again, as the air was filled with a loud, crinkling, snapping sound. Sitting at the table, busily mixing and measuring, was the man who had invited them in. He was wearing a long white coat with a stethoscope around his neck and a small round mirror attached to his forehead, and the only really noticeable things about him were his tiny mustache and his enormous ears, each of which was fully as large as his head.
"Are you a doctor?"
asked Milo, trying to feel as well as possible.
"I am Cacophonous A. Discord, Doctor of Dissonance,"
roared the man, and as he spoke, several small explosions and a grinding crash were heard.
"What does the A stand for?" stammered the nervous bug, too frightened to move.
"As loud as possible,"
bellowed the doctor, and two screeches and a bump accompanied his response.
"Now step a little closer and stick out your tongues." "Just as I suspected,"
he continued, opening a large dusty book and thumbing through the pages.
"You're suffering from a severe lack of noise."
He began to jump around the wagon, snatching bottles from the shelves until he had a large assortment in various colors and sizes collected at one end of the table. All were neatly labeled. Loud cries, soft cries, bangs, bongs, smashes, crashes, swishes, swooshes, snaps and crackles, whistles and gongs, squeaks, squawks, and miscellaneous uproar. After pouring a little of each into a large glass beaker, he stirred the mixture thoroughly with a wooden spoon, watching intently as it smoked and steamed and boiled and bubbled.
"Be ready in just a moment,"
he explained, rubbing his hands. Milo had never seen such unpleasant-looking medicine and wasn't at all anxious to try any.
"Just what kind of a doctor are you?" he asked suspiciously.
"Well, you might say I'm a specialist," said the doctor. "I specialize in noise, all kinds, from the loudest to the softest, and from the slightly annoying to the terribly unpleasant. For instance, have you ever heard a square-wheeled steamroller ride over a street full of hard-boiled eggs?"
he asked, and as he did, all that could be heard were loud crunching sounds.
But who would want all those terrible noises?" asked Milo, holding his ears.
"Everybody does," said the surprised doctor. "They're very popular today. Why, I'm kept so busy I can hardly fill the orders for noise pills, racket lotion, clamor salve, and hubbub tonic. That's all people seem to want these days."
He stirred the beaker of liquid a few more times, and then, as the steam cleared, continued,
"Business wasn't always so good. Years ago, everyone wanted pleasant sounds, and except for a few orders during wars and earthquakes, things were very bad. But then the big cities were built, and there was a great need for honking horns, screeching trains, clanging bells, deafening shouts, piercing shrieks, gurgling drains, and all the rest of those wonderfully unpleasant sounds we use so much of today. Without them, people would be very unhappy, so I make sure that they get as much as they want. Why, if you take a little of my medicine every day, you'll never have to hear a beautiful sound again. Here, try some."
"If it's all the same to you, I'd rather not,"
said the humbug, backing away to the far corner of the wagon.
I don't want to be cured of beautiful sounds, insisted Milo.
Besides, growled Tuck,
who decided that he didn't much like Dr. Discord,
there is no such illness as lack of noise.
Of course not,
replied the doctor, pouring himself a small glass of the liquid.
That's what makes it so difficult to cure. I only treat illnesses that don't exist. That way, if I can't cure them, there's no harm done. Just one of the precautions of the trade,
he concluded. And seeing that no one was about to take his medicine, he again reached toward the shelf, removed a dark amber bottle, dusted it carefully, and placed it on the table in front of him.
Very well. If you want to go all through life suffering from a noise deficiency, I'll give it all to the Din for his lunch,
he said, and he uncorked the bottle with a hollow-sounding pop. For a moment, everything was quiet as Milo, Tok, and the humbug looked intently at the bottle, wondering what Dr. Discord would do next. Then, very faintly at first, they heard a low rumbling that sounded miles away. It grew louder and louder and louder and closer and closer and closer until it became a deafening, ear-splitting roar that seemed to be coming from inside the tiny bottle. Then, from the bottle, a thick bluish smog spiraled to the ceiling, spread out and gradually assumed the shape of a thick bluish smog with hands, feet, bright yellow eyes, and a large frowning mouth. As soon as the smog had gotten completely out of the bottle, it grasped the beaker of liquid, tilted back what would have been its head, if it really had one, and drank it all in three gulps.
That was good, master,
he bellowed, shaking the whole wagon.
I thought you'd never let me out. Terribly cramped in there.
This is my assistant, the awful Din, said Dr. Discord. You must forgive his appearance, for he really doesn't have any. You see, he is an orphan whom I raised myself, without benefit of governess or any other assistance, for—
No nurse is good nurse,
interrupted the Din, doubling up with laughter. If you can imagine a thick bluish smog doubling up with laughter.
For I found him,
continued the doctor, ignoring his outburst,
living alone and unwanted in an abandoned soda bottle, without family or relatives.
No niece is good niece,
roared the Din again, with a laugh that sounded like several sirens going off at once, and he slapped at where his knee should have been.
And brought him here, continued the exasperated Discord, where, despite his lack of shape or features, I train—
No nose is good nose,
thundered the Din once again as he collapsed in another fit of hysterics and clutched his sides.
I trained him as my assistant in the business of concocting and dispensing noise, finished the doctor, mopping his brow with a handkerchief.
No noise is good noise,
exclaimed the humbug happily, trying to catch the spirit of things.
That's not funny at all,
sobbed the Din, who went to a corner and sulked.
What is a Din? Asked Milo when he had recovered from the shock of seeing him appear.
You mean you've never met the awful Din before?
Said Dr. Discord in a surprised tone.
Why, I thought everyone had. When you're playing in your room and making a great amount of noise, what do they tell you to stop?
That awful Din, admitted Milo.
When the neighbors are playing their radio too loud, late at night, what do you wish they'd turn down?
That awful Din, answered Tuck.
When the street of your block is being repaired and the pneumatic drills are working all day, what does everyone complain of?
The dreadful row,
volunteered the humbug brightly.
The dreadful row,
cried the anguished Din,
was my grandfather. He perished in the Great Silence epidemic of 1712.
Milo felt so sorry for the unhappy Din that he gave him his handkerchief, which was immediately covered in bluish, smoggy tears.
Thank you, groaned the Din. That's very kind. But I certainly can't understand why you don't like noise, he said. Why, I heard an explosion last week that was so lovely I cried for 2 days.
The very thought of it upset him so much that he began to sob all over again, in a way that sounded almost exactly like a handful of fingernails being scratched across a mile-long blackboard. He buried his head in the doctor's lap.
"He's very sensitive, isn't he?"
asked Milo, trying to comfort the emotional Din.
"It's true," agreed Dr. Discord. "But he's right, you know, for noise is the most valuable thing in the world."
"King Azaz says words are," said Milo.
"Nonsense!"
the doctor roared.
"Why, when a baby wants food, how does he ask?"
"He screams,"
answered the Din, looking up happily.
"And when an automobile wants gas?"
"It chokes,"
he shouted again, jumping for joy.
"When a river wants water, what does it do?"
"It creaks,"
bellowed the Din as he collapsed into a fit of uncontrolled laughter.
"And what happens when a new day begins?"
"It breaks,"
he gasped joyfully from the floor, a look of utter bliss covering his face.
"You see how simple it is,"
the doctor said to Milo, who didn't see at all. And then, turning to the tear-stained, smiling Din, he remarked,
"Isn't it time for you to go?"
"Where to?" asked Milo. "Perhaps we're going the same way."
"I think not," the Din replied, picking up an armful of empty sacks from the table. "For I'm going on my noise collection rounds. You see, once a day I travel throughout the kingdom and collect all the wonderfully horrible and beautifully unpleasant noises that have been made, pack them into my sacks, and bring them back here for the doctor to make his medicines from."
"And a good job he does,"
said Dr. Discord, pounding his fist on the table.
"So wherever the noise is, that's where you'll find me," said the Din with an appreciative smile. "And I must hurry along, for I understand that today there's to be a screech, several loud crashes, and a bit of pandemonium."
"And in which direction are you going?"
asked the doctor, mixing another brew.
"To Digitopolis," replied Milo.
"How unfortunate,"
he said, as the Din shuffled toward the door.
"How very unfortunate, for then you must pass through the Valley of Sound."
"Is that bad?"
asked the perpetually worried humbug. The Din paused in the doorway with a look of extreme horror on his almost featureless face, and the doctor shuddered in a way that sounded very much like a fast-moving freight train being derailed into a mountain of custard.
"Well, you might ask, for you will find out soon enough,"
was all he would say, as he sadly bade them farewell, and the Din galloped off on his rounds. Chapter 12. The Silent Valley.
"How agreeable and pleasant this valley is," thought Milo, as once again they bounced along the highway, with the humbug humming snatches of old songs to his own vast amusement, and talk sniffing contentedly at the wind. "I really can't see what Dr. Discord was so concerned about. There certainly couldn't be anything unpleasant along this road."
And just as the thought crossed his mind, they passed through a heavy stone gateway, and everything was very different. At first it was difficult to tell just what had changed. It all looked the same, and it all smelled the same. But for some reason, nothing sounded the same.
"I wonder what's happened," said Milo.
At least that's what he tried to say, for, although his lips moved, not a sound came from his mouth. And suddenly he realized what it was, for talk was no longer ticking, and the humbug, although happily singing, was doing so in complete silence. The winds no longer rustled the leaves, the car no longer squeaked, and the insects no longer buzzed in the fields. Not the slightest thing could be heard, and it felt as if, in some mysterious way, a switch had been thrown, and all the sound in the world had been turned off at the same instant. The humbug, suddenly realizing what had happened, leaped to his feet in terror, and Tok worriedly checked to see if he was still keeping time. It was certainly a strange feeling to know that no matter how loudly or softly you chatted or rattled or bumped, it all came out to the same way, as nothing.
"How dreadful," thought Milo as he slowed down the car.
The three of them began to talk and shout at once with absolutely no result, until, hardly noticing where they were going, they had driven into the midst of a large crowd of people marching along the road. Some of them were singing at the tops of their non-existent voices, and the others were carrying large signs which proclaimed, "Down with silence! All quiet is no diet! It's laudable to be audible! More sound for all!" And one enormous banner stated simply, "Hear, hear!" Except for these, and the big brass cannon being pulled along behind, they all looked very much like the residents of any other small valley to which you've never been. When the car had stopped, one of them held up a placard which said, "Welcome to the Valley of Sound," and the others cheered as loudly as possible, which was not very loud at all. "Have you come to help us?" asked another, stepping forward with his question.
"Please,"
added a third. Milo tried desperately to say who he was and where he was going, but to no avail. As he did, four more placards announced, "Listen, look carefully, and we will tell you of our terrible misfortune." And while two of them held up a large blackboard, a third, writing as fast as he could, explained why there was nothing but quiet in the Valley of Sound. "At a place in the valley not far from here," he began, "where the echoes used to gather and the winds came to rest, there is a great stone fortress, and in it lives the Soundkeeper who rules this land. When the old King of Wisdom drove the demons into the distant mountains, he appointed her guardian of all sounds and noises, past, present, and future. For years she ruled as a wise and beloved monarch, each morning at sunrise releasing the day's new sounds, to be borne by the winds throughout the kingdom, and each night at moonset gathering in the old sounds to be catalogued and filed in the vast storage vaults below." The writer paused for a moment to mop his brow, and then, since the blackboard was full, erased it completely and continued anew from the top. "She was generous to a fault, and provided us with all the sound we could possibly use, for singing as we worked, for bubbling pots of stew, for the chop of an axe and the crash of a tree, for the creak of a hinge and the hoot of an owl, for the squish of a shoe in the mud and the friendly tapping of rain on a roof, and for the sweet music of pipes and the sharp snap of winter ice cracking on the ground. He paused again as a tear of longing rolled from cheek to lip with the sweet salty taste of an old memory.
And all these sounds, when once used, would be carefully placed in alphabetical order and neatly kept for future reference. Everyone lived in peace, and the valley flourished as the happy home of sound, but then things began to change. Slowly at first, and then in a rush, more people came to settle here and brought with them new ways and new sounds, some very beautiful and some less so. But everyone was so busy with the things that had to be done that they scarcely had time to listen at all. And, as you know, a sound which is not heard disappears forever and is not to be found again. People laughed less and grumbled more, sang less and shouted more, and the sounds they made grew louder and uglier. It became difficult to hear even the birds or the breeze, and soon everyone stopped listening for them. He again cleared the blackboard as the humbug choked back a sob and continued writing. The soundkeeper grew worried and disconsolate. Each day there were fewer sounds to be collected, and most of those were hardly worth keeping. Many people thought it was the weather, and others blamed the moon, but the general consensus of opinion held that the trouble began at the time that rhyme and reason were banished. But, no matter what the cause, no one knew what to do. Then one day Dr. Discord appeared in the valley with his wagon of medicines and a bluish, smoggy din. He made a thorough examination, and promised to cure everyone of everything, and the soundkeeper let him try. He gave several bad-tasting spoonfuls of medicine to every adult and child, and it worked. But not really as expected, for he cured everybody of everything but noise. The soundkeeper became furious. She chased him from the valley forever, and then issued the following decree.
From this day forward, the Valley of Sound shall be silent. Since sound is no longer appreciated, I hereby abolish it. Please return all unused amounts to the fortress immediately.
And that's the way it has been ever since, he continued sadly. There's nothing we can do to change it, and each day new hardships are reported. A small man, with his arms full of letters and messages, pushed through the crowd and offered them to Milo. Milo took one, which read, "Dear Soundkeeper, we had a thunderstorm last week, and the thunder still hasn't arrived. How long should we wait? Yours truly, a friend." Then he took a telegram, which stated, "Band concert, great success, stop. When may we expect the music, stop." "Now you see," continued the writer, "why you must help us attack the fortress and free sound."
"What can I do?" wrote Milo.
"You must visit the soundkeeper and bring from the fortress one sound, no matter how small, with which to load our cannon. For if we can reach the walls with the slightest noise, they will collapse and free the rest. It won't be easy, for she is hard to deceive, but you must try." Milo thought for just a moment, and then, with a resolute, "I shall," volunteered to go. Within a few minutes, he stood bravely at the fortress door. "Knock, knock," he wrote neatly on a piece of paper, which he pushed under the crack. In a moment, the great portal swung open, and, as it closed behind him, a gentle voice sang out,
"Right this way! I'm in the parlor!"
"Can I talk now?"
cried Milo happily, hearing his voice once again.
"Yes, but only in here," she replied softly. "Now do come into the parlor!"
Milo walked slowly down the long hallway and into the little room where the soundkeeper sat listening intently to an enormous radio set, whose switches, dials, knobs, meters, and speaker covered one whole wall, and which at the moment was playing nothing.
"Isn't that lovely?" she sighed. "It's my favorite program. 15 minutes of silence, and after that there's a half hour of quiet, and then an interlude of lull. Why, did you know there are almost as many kinds of stillness as there are sounds? But sadly enough, no one pays any attention to them these days. Have you ever heard the wonderful silence just before the dawn?"
she inquired.
"Or the calm and quiet just as a storm ends? Or perhaps you know the silence when you haven't the answer to a question you've been asked, or the hush of a country road at night, or the expectant pause in a room full of people when someone is just about to speak, or, most beautiful of all, the moment after the door closes and you're all alone in the whole house? Each one is different, you know, and all very beautiful, if you listen carefully."
As she spoke, the thousands of little bells and chimes which covered her from head to toe tinkled softly, and as if in reply, the telephone began to ring too.
"For someone who loves silence, she certainly talks a great deal," thought Milo.
"At one time I was able to listen to any sound made any place at any time,"
the soundkeeper remarked, pointing towards the radio wall.
"But now I'm merely..."
"Pardon me," interrupted Milo as the phone continued to ring. "But aren't you going to answer it?"
"Oh no, not in the middle of the program,"
she replied, and turned the silence up a little louder.
"But it may be important," insisted Milo.
"Not at all," she assured him. "It's only me. It gets so lonely around here, with no sounds to distribute or collect, that I call myself 7 or 8 times a day, just to see how I am."
"How are you?" he asked politely.
"Not very well, I'm afraid. I seem to have a touch of static,"
she complained.
"But what brings you here? Of course, you've come to tour the vaults. Well, they're usually open to the public only on Mondays from 2 to 4, but since you've traveled so far, we'll have to make an exception. Follow me, please.
She quickly bounced to her feet with a chorus of jingles and chimes and started down the hallway.
Don't you just love jingles and chimes? I do,
she answered quickly.
Besides, they're very convenient, for I'm always getting lost in this big fortress, and all I have to do is listen for them, and then I know exactly where I am.
They entered a tiny cage-like elevator and traveled down for fully 3/4 of a minute, stopping finally in an immense vault, whose long lines of file drawers and storage bins stretched in all directions from where here began to where there ended, and from floor to ceiling.
Every sound that's ever been made in history is kept here,
said the soundkeeper, skipping down one of the corridors with Milo in hand.
For instance, look here.
She opened one of the drawers and pulled out a small brown envelope.
This is the exact tune George Washington whistled when he crossed the Delaware on that icy night in 1777.
Milo peered into the envelope, and sure enough, that's exactly what was in it.
But why do you collect them all? He asked as she closed the drawer.
If we didn't collect them, said the soundkeeper as they continued to stroll through the vault, the air would be full of old sounds and noises bouncing around and bumping into things. It would be terribly confusing, because you'd never know whether you were listening to an old one or a new one. Besides, I do like to collect things, and there are more sounds than almost anything else. Why, I have everything here from the buzz of a mosquito 1,000,000 years ago to what your mother said to you this morning. And if you come back here in 2 days, I'll tell you what she said tomorrow. It's really very simple. Let me show you. Say a word. Any word.
Hello,
said Milo, for that was all he could think of.
Now, where do you think it went?
She asked with a smile.
I don't know, said Milo, shrugging his shoulders. I always thought that...
Most people do.
She hummed, peering down one of the corridors.
Now, let me see. First we find the cabinet with today's sounds. Ah, here it is. Then we look under G for greetings, then under M for Milo, and here it is, already in its envelope. So you see, the whole system is quite automatic. It's a shame we hardly use it anymore.
That's wonderful, guessed Milo. May I have one little sound as a souvenir?
Certainly,
she said with pride, and then, immediately thinking better of it, added,
not. And don't try to take one, because it's strictly against the rules.
Milo was crestfallen. He had no idea how to steal a sound, even the smallest one, for the soundkeeper always had at least one eye carefully focused on him.
"Now for a look at the workshops," she cried,
whisking him through another door and into a large abandoned laboratory full of old pieces of equipment, all untended and rusting.
"This is where we used to invent the sounds," she said wistfully.
"Did they have to be invented?"
asked Milo, who seemed surprised at almost everything she told him.
"I thought they just were."
"No one realizes how much trouble we go through to make them," she complained. "Why, at one time this shop was crowded and busy from morning to night."
"But how do you invent a sound?" Milo inquired.
"Oh, that's very easy," she said. "First you must decide exactly what the sound looks like, for each sound has its own exact shape and size. Then you make some of them here in the shop, and grind each one 3 times into an invisible powder, and throw a little of each into the air every time you need it."
"But I've never seen a sound," Milo insisted.
"You never see them out there," she said, waving her arm in the general direction of everywhere, "except every once in a while on a very cold morning when they freeze. But in here we see them all the time. Here, let me show you."
She picked up a padded stick and struck a nearby bass drum 6 times. 6 large, woolly, fluffy cotton balls, each about 2 feet across, rolled silently out onto the floor.
"You see," she said, putting some of them into a large grinder. "Now listen."
And she took a pinch of the invisible powder and threw it into the air with a boom, 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 boom.
"Do you know what a hand clap looks like?"
Milo shook his head.
"Try it," she commanded.
He clapped his hands once, and a single sheet of clean white paper fluttered to the floor. He tried it 3 more times, and 3 more sheets of paper did the very same thing. And then he applauded as fast as he could, and a great cascade of papers filled the air.
"Isn't that simple? And it's the same for all sounds. If you think about it, you'll soon know what each one looks like. Take laughter, for instance," she said, laughing brightly, and 1,000 tiny, brightly colored bubbles flew into the air and popped noiselessly.
"Or speech," she continued.
"Some of it is light and airy, some sharp and pointed, but most of it, I'm afraid, is just heavy and dull."
"How about music?" asked Milo excitedly.
"Right over here. We weave it on our looms. Symphonies are the large, beautiful carpets with all the rhythms and melodies woven in. Concertos are these tapestries, and all the other bolts of cloth are serenades, waltzes, overtures, and rhapsodies. And we also have some of the songs that you often sing," she cried, holding up a handful of brightly colored handkerchiefs.
She stopped for a moment and said sadly,
"We even had one section over there that did nothing but put the sound of the ocean into seashells. This was once such a happy place."
"Then why don't you make sound for everyone now?" he shouted so eagerly that the soundkeeper leaped back in surprise.
"Don't shout so, young man. If there's one thing we need more of around here, it's less noise. Now come with me, and I'll tell you all about it. And put that down immediately."
Her last remark was directed towards Milo's efforts to stuff one of the large drum beats into his back pocket. They returned quickly to the parlor, and when the soundkeeper had settled herself in a chair and carefully tuned the radio to a special hour of hush, Milo asked his question once again, in a somewhat lower voice.
"It doesn't make me happy to hold back the sounds," she began softly, "for if we listen to them carefully, they can sometimes tell us things far better than words."
"But if that's so," asked Milo, and he had no doubt that it was, "shouldn't you release them?"
"Never!" she cried. "They just use them to make horrible noises which are ugly to see and worse to hear. I leave all that to Dr. Discord and that awful, awful din."
"But some noises are good sounds, aren't they?" he insisted.
"That may be true," she replied stubbornly. "But if they won't make the sounds that I like, they won't make any."
He started to say, and had got no further than that. For while he was about to say that he didn't think that it was quite fair, a thought to which the obstinate soundkeeper might not have taken kindly, he suddenly discovered the way he would carry his little sound from the fortress. In the instant between saying the word and before it sailed off into the air, he had clamped his lips shut, and the "but" was trapped in his mouth, all made, but not spoken.
"Well, I mustn't keep you all day," she said impatiently. "Now turn your pockets out so that I can see you didn't steal anything, and you can be on your way."
When he had satisfied the soundkeeper, he nodded his farewell, for it would have been most impractical to say, "Thank you," or "Good afternoon," and raced out the door.
Chapter 13. Unfortunate Conclusions. With his mouth shut tight and his feet moving as fast as thoughts could make them, Milo ran all the way back to the car. There was great excitement when he arrived, as Tok raced happily down the road to greet him. The humbug personally accepted all congratulations from the crowd.
"Where is the sound?"
someone hastily scribbled on the blackboard, and they all waited anxiously for the reply. Milo caught his breath, picked up the chalk, and explained simply,
"It's on the tip of my tongue."
Several people excitedly threw their hats into the air. Some shouted what would have been a loud hurrah, and the rest pushed the heavy cannon into place. They aimed it directly at the thickest part of the fortress wall and packed it full of gunpowder. Milo stood on tiptoe, leaned over into the cannon's mouth, and parted his lips. The small sound dropped silently to the bottom, and everything was ready. In another moment, the fuse was lit and sputtering.
"I hope no one gets hurt," thought Milo, and before he had time to think again, an immense cloud of gray and white smoke leapt from the gun, and along with it, so softly that it was hardly heard, came the sound of, "But..."
It flew toward the wall for several seconds in a high, lazy arc, and then struck ever so lightly just to the right of the big door. For an instant, there was an ominous stillness, quieter and more silent than ever before, as if even the air was holding its breath. And then, almost immediately, there was a blasting, roaring, thundering smash, followed by a crushing, shattering, bursting crash, as every stone in the fortress came toppling to the ground, and the vaults burst open, spilling the sounds of history into the wind. Every sound that had ever been uttered or made, from way back to when there were none, to way up when there were too many, came hurtling out of the debris in a way that sounded as though everyone in the world was laughing, whistling, shouting, crying, singing, whispering, humming, screaming, coughing, and sneezing, all at the same time. There were bits of old speeches floating about, as well as recited lessons, gunshots from old wars, babies' cries, auto horns, waterfalls, electric fans, galloping horses, and a great deal of everything else. For a while there was total and deafening confusion, and then, almost as quickly as they'd come, all the old sounds disappeared over the hill in search of their new freedom, and things were normal again. The people quickly went about their busy, talkative business, and, as the smoke and dust cleared, only Milo, Tok, and the humbug noticed the soundkeeper sitting disconsolately on a pile of rubble.
"I'm terribly sorry," said Milo sympathetically as the three of them went to console her.
"But we had to do it,"
added Tok, sniffing around the ruins.
"What a terrible mess,"
observed the humbug, with his knack for saying exactly the wrong thing. The soundkeeper looked around with an expression of unrelieved sadness on her unhappy face.
"It will take years to collect all those sounds again," she sobbed, "and even longer to put them back in proper order. But it's all my fault, for you can't improve sound by having only silence. The problem is to use each at the proper time."
As she spoke, the familiar and unmistakable squinch-squanch, squinch-squanch of the din's heavy footsteps could be heard plodding over the hill, and when he finally appeared, he was dragging an incredibly large sack behind him.
"Can anyone use these sounds?"
he puffed, mopping his forehead.
"They all came over the hill at once, and none of them are awful enough for me."
The soundkeeper peered into the sack, and there were all the sounds which had burst from the vaults.
"How nice of you to return them!" she cried happily. "You and the doctor must come by for an evening of beautiful music when my fortress is repaired."
The thought of it so horrified the Dean that he excused himself immediately and dashed off down the road in a great panic.
"I hope I haven't offended him," she said with some concern.
"He only likes unpleasant sounds," volunteered Tok.
"Ah, yes," she sighed. "I keep forgetting that many people do. But I suppose they're necessary, for you never really know how pleasant one was unless you knew how unpleasant it wasn't."
She paused for a moment, then continued.
"If only rhyme and reason were here, I'm sure things would improve."
"That's why we're going to rescue them," said Milo proudly.
"What a long, hard journey that will be. You'll need some nourishment," she cried, handing Milo a small brown package, neatly wrapped and tied with string. "Now remember, they're not for eating, but for listening, because you'll often be hungry for sounds as well as food. Here are street noises at night, train whistles a long way off, dry leaves burning, busy department stores, crunching toast, creaking bed springs, and of course, all kinds of laughter. There's a little of each, and in far-off lonely places, I think you'll be glad to have them."
"I'm sure we will," replied Milo gratefully.
"Just take this road to the sea and turn left," she told them. "You'll soon be in Digitopolis."
And almost before she had finished, they had said goodbye and left the valley behind them. The shoreline was peaceful and flat, and the calm sea bumped it playfully along the sandy beach. In the distance, a beautiful island covered with palm trees and flowers beckoned invitingly from the sparkling water.
"Nothing can possibly go wrong now,"
cried the humbug happily, and as soon as he'd said it, he leaped from the car as if struck by a pin and sailed all the way to the little island.
"And we'll have plenty of time," answered Tok,
who hadn't noticed that the bug was missing, and he, too, suddenly leapt into the air and disappeared.
"It certainly couldn't be a nicer day," agreed Milo, who was too busy looking at the road to see that the others had gone.
And in a split second, he was gone also. He landed next to Tok and the terrified humbug on the tiny island, which now looked completely different. Instead of palms and flowers, there were only rocks and the twisted stumps of long dead trees. It certainly didn't seem like the same place they had seen from the road.
"Pardon me," said Milo to the first man who happened by. "Can you tell me where I am?"
"Pardon me," replied the man. "Can you tell me who I am?"
The man was dressed in a shaggy tweed jacket and knickers with long woolen stockings and a cap that had a peak both front and back, and he seemed as confused as he could be.
"You must know who you are," said Milo impatiently.
"You must know where you are," he replied with equal annoyance.
"Oh dear, this is going to be difficult," Milo whispered to Tok. "I wonder if we can help him."
They conferred for a few minutes, and finally the bug looked up and said,
"Can you describe yourself?"
"Ah, yes indeed," the man replied happily. "I'm as tall as can be."
And he grew straight up until all that could be seen of him were his shoes and stockings.
"I'm as short as can be," and he shrank down to the size of a pebble. "I'm as generous as can be," he said, handing each of them a large red apple. "And I'm as selfish as can be," he snarled, grabbing them back again. "I'm as strong as can be," he roared, lifting an enormous boulder over his head. "And I'm as weak as can be," he gasped, staggering under the weight of his hat. "I'm as smart as can be," he remarked in 12 different languages. "And I'm as stupid as can be," he admitted, putting both feet in one shoe. "I'm as graceful as can be," he hummed, balancing on one toe. "And I'm as clumsy as can be," he cried, sticking his thumb in his eye. "I'm as fast as can be," he announced, running around the island twice in no time at all. "And I'm as slow as can be," he complained, waving goodbye to a snail. "Is that any help to you?" Once again, they conferred in busy whispers until all three agreed.
"It's really very simple," said the humbug, twirling his cane.
"If everything you say is true," added Tok.
"Then without a doubt," Milo concluded brightly, "you must be Canby."
"Of course, yes, of course," the man shouted. "Why did not think of that? I'm as happy as can be."
Then he quickly sat down, put his head in his hands, and sighed. "But I'm also as sad as can be."
"Now, will you tell me where we are?"
asked Tok as he looked around the desolate island.
"To be sure," said Canby, "you're on the island of conclusions. Make yourself at home. You're apt to be here for some time."
"But how did we get here?" asked Milo, who was still a bit puzzled by being there at all.
"You jumped, of course," explained Canby. "That's the way most everyone gets here. It's really quite simple. Every time you decide something, without having a good reason, you jump to conclusions whether you like it or not. It's such an easy trip to make up on here hundreds of times."
"But this is such an unpleasant-looking place," Milo remarked.
"Yeah, that's true," admitted Canby. "It does look much better from a distance."
As he spoke, at least 8 or 9 more people sailed onto the island from every direction possible.
"Well, I'm going to jump right back," announced the humbug,
who took 2 or 3 practice bends, leapt as far as he could, and landed in a heap 2 feet away.
"That won't do at all,"
scolded Canby, helping him to his feet. "You can never jump away from conclusions. Getting back's not so easy. That's why we're so terribly crowded here."
That was certainly the truth, for all along the bleak shore, and clustered on the rocks for as far as anyone could see, were enormous crowds of people, all sadly looking out to sea.
"Isn't there even a boat?" asked Milo, anxious to get on with his trip.
"Oh, no," replied Canby, shaking his head. "The only way back is to swim, and that's a very long and a very hard way."
"I don't like to get wet," moaned the unhappy bug, and he shuddered at the thought.
"Neither do they," said Canby sadly. "That's what keeps him here. But I wouldn't worry too much about it, for you can swim all day in the Sea of Knowledge and still come out completely dry. Most people do. But you must excuse me now, I have to greet the new arrivals. As you know, I'm as friendly as can be."
Over the humbug's strenuous objections, Milo and Tuck decided to swim, and, protesting loudly, the bug was dragged along with them toward the sea. Canby hurried off to answer more questions, and the last thing he was heard to say was,
"Pardon me, can you tell me who I am?"
They swam and swam and swam for what seemed like hours, and only Tuck's firm encouragement kept Milo struggling through the icy water. At last they reached the shore, thoroughly exhausted, and, except for the bug, completely soaked.
"That wasn't bad at all," the humbug said, straightening his tie and brushing himself off. "I must visit there again."
"I'm sure you will," gasped Milo. "But from now on, I'm going to have a very good reason before I make up my mind about anything. You can lose too much time jumping to conclusions."
The car was just where they'd left it, and in a moment they were on their way again as the road turned away from the sea and began its long climb into the mountains. The warm sun and billowy breezes dried them as they went.
"I hope we reach Digitopolis soon," said Milo, thinking of the breakfast they hadn't eaten. "I wonder how far it is."
Chapter 14. The Dodecahedron Leads the Way. Up ahead, the road divided into three, and, as if in reply to Milo's question, an enormous road sign, pointing in all three directions, stated clearly,
"Digitopolis, 5 miles, 1,600 rods, 8,800 yards, 26,400 feet, 316,800 inches, 633,600 half inches, and then some."
"Let's travel by miles," advised the humbug. "It's shorter."
"Let's travel by half inches," suggested Milo. "It's quicker."
"But which road should we take?" asked Tuck. "It must make a difference."
As they argued, a most peculiar little figure stepped nimbly from behind the sign and approached them, talking all the while.
"Yes, indeed. Indeed, it does. Certainly. My, yes, it does make a difference. Undoubtedly."
He was constructed, for that's really the only way to describe him, of a large assortment of lines and angles connected together into one solid, many-sided shape, somewhat like a cube that's had all its corners cut off and then had all its corners cut off again. Each of the edges was neatly labeled with a small letter, and each of the angles with a large one. He wore a handsome beret on top, and peering intently from one of his several surfaces was a very serious face. Perhaps if you look at the picture, you'll know what I mean. When he reached the car, the figure doffed his cap and recited in a loud, clear voice, "My angles are many. My sides are not few. I'm the Dodecahedron. Who are you?"
"What's a dodecahedron?" inquired Milo, who was barely able to pronounce the strange word.
"See for yourself,"
he said, turning around slowly.
"A dodecahedron is a mathematical shape with 12 faces."
Just as he said it, 11 other faces appeared, one on each surface, and each one wore a different expression.
"I usually use one at a time," he confided, as all but the smiley one disappeared again. "It saves wear and tear. What are you called?"
"Milo," said Milo.
"That is an odd name," he said, changing his smiling face for a frowning one. "And you only have one face."
"Is that bad?" asked Milo, making sure it was still there.
"You'll soon wear it out using it for everything," replied the dodecahedron. "Now I have one for smiling, one for laughing, one for crying, one for frowning, one for thinking, one for pouting, and 6 more besides. Is everyone with one face called a Milo?"
"Oh no," Milo replied. "Some are called Henry or George or Robert or John or lots of other things."
"How terribly confusing," he cried. "Everything here is called exactly what it is. The triangles are called triangles, the circles are called circles, and even the same numbers have the same name. Why can't you imagine what would happen if we named all the twos Henry or George or Robert or John or lots of other things?
you'd have to say Robert plus John equals 4. And if the 4's name were Albert, things would be hopeless.
I never thought of it that way, Milo admitted.
Then I suggest you begin at once, admonished the dodecahedron from his admonishing face. For here in Digitopolis, everything is quite precise.
Then perhaps you can help us decide which road to take, said Milo.
By all means, he replied happily. There's nothing to it. If a small car carrying 3 people at 30 miles an hour for 10 minutes along a road 5 miles long at 11:35 in the morning starts at the same time as 3 people who have been traveling in a little automobile at 20 miles an hour for 15 minutes on another road, exactly twice as long as one half the distance of the other, while a dog, a pug, and a boy travel an equal distance in the same time or the same distance in an equal time along a third road in mid-October, then which one arrives first and which is the best way to go?
17! Shouted the humbug, scribbling furiously on a piece of paper.
Well, I'm not sure, but... Milo stammered after several minutes of frantic figuring.
You'll have to do better than that, scolded the dodecahedron, or you'll never know how far you've gone, or whether or not you've ever gotten there.
I'm not very good at problems, admitted Milo.
What a shame, sighed the dodecahedron. They're so very useful. Why, did you know that if a beaver 2 feet long, with a tail 1 foot and a half long, can build a dam 12 feet high and 6 feet wide in 2 days, all you would need to build Boulder Dam is a beaver 68 feet long with a 51-foot tail?
Where would you find a beaver that big? Grumbled the humbug as his pencil point snapped.
I'm sure I don't know, he replied, but if you did, you'd certainly know what to do with him.
That's absurd, objected Milo, whose head was spinning from all the numbers and questions.
That may be true, he acknowledged, but it's completely accurate, and as long as the answer is right, who cares if the question is wrong? If you want sense, you'll have to make it yourself.
All 3 roads arrive at the same place at the same time,
interrupted Tok, who had patiently been doing the first problem. Correct, shouted the dodecahedron, and I'll take you there myself. Now you can see how important problems are. If you hadn't done this one properly, you might have gone the wrong way.
I can't see where I made my mistake, said the humbug, frantically rechecking his figures.
But if all the roads arrive at the same place at the same time, then aren't they all the right way? Asked Milo.
Certainly not, he shouted, glaring from his most upset face. They're all the wrong way. Just because you have a choice, it doesn't mean that any of them has to be right.
He walked to the sign and quickly spun it around 3 times. As he did, the 3 roads vanished, and a new one suddenly appeared, heading in the direction that the sign now pointed.
Is every road 5 miles from Digitopolis? Asked Milo.
I'm afraid it has to be,
the dodecahedron replied, leaping onto the back of the car.
It's the only sign we've got.
The new road was quite bumpy and full of stones, and each time they hit one, the dodecahedron bounced into the air and landed on one of his faces, with a sulk or a smile or a laugh or a frown, depending on which one it was.
We'll soon be there, he announced happily after one of his short flights. Welcome to the land of numbers!
It doesn't look very inviting,
the bug remarked, for as they climbed higher and higher, not a tree or a blade of grass could be seen anywhere. Only the rocks remained.
Is this the place where numbers are made?
Asked Milo as the car lurched again, and this time the dodecahedron sailed off down the mountainside, head over heels, and grunt over grimace, until he landed, sad side up, at what looked like the entrance to a cave.
They're not made, he replied, as if nothing had happened. You have to dig for them. Don't you know anything at all about numbers?
Well, I don't think they're very important, snapped Milo, too embarrassed to admit the truth.
Not important? Roared the dodecahedron, turning red with fury. Could you have tea for 2 without the 2, or 3 blind mice without the 3? Would there be 4 corners of the earth if there weren't a 4? And how would you sail the 7 seas without a 7?
All I meant was, began Milo, but the dodecahedron, overcome with emotion and shouting furiously, carried right on.
If you had high hopes, how would you know how high they were? And did you know that narrow escapes come in all different widths? Would you travel the whole wide world without ever knowing how wide it was? And how could you do anything at long last?
he concluded, waving his arms over his head, without knowing how long the last was. Why, numbers are the most beautiful and valuable things in the world. Just follow me and I'll show you. He turned on his heel and stalked off into the cave. Come along, come along, he shouted from the dark hole. I can't wait for you all day. And in a moment they followed him into the mountain. It took several minutes for their eyes to become accustomed to the dim light, and during that time strange scratching, scraping, tapping, and scuffling noises could be heard all around them. Put these on, instructed the dodecahedron, handing each of them a helmet with a flashlight attached to the top. Where are we going? Whispered Milo, for it seemed like the kind of place in which he whispered. We're here, he replied with a sweeping gesture. This is the numbers mine. Milo squinted into the darkness and saw for the first time that they had entered a vast cavern, lit only by a soft, eerie glow from the great stalactites which hung ominously from the ceiling. Passages and corridors honeycombed the walls and wound their way from floor to ceiling up and down the sides of the cave. And everywhere he looked, Milo saw little men no bigger than himself busy digging and chopping, shoveling and scraping, pulling and tugging carts full of stone from one place to another. Right this way, instructed the dodecahedron, and watch where you step. As he spoke, his voice echoed and re-echoed and re-echoed again, mixing its sound with the buzz of activity all around them. Tok trotted along next to Milo, and the humbug, stepping daintily, followed behind. "Whose mine is it?" asked Milo, stepping around two of the loaded wagons.
"By the 4,827,659 hairs on my head, it's mine, of course!"
bellowed a voice from across the cavern, and striding toward them came a figure who could only have been the mathemagician. He was dressed in a long flowing robe covered entirely with complex mathematical equations and a tall pointed cap that made him look very wise. In his left hand he carried a long staff with a pencil point at one end and a large rubber eraser at the other.
"It's a lovely mine," apologized the humbug, who was always intimidated by loud noises. "The biggest number mine in the kingdom," said the mathemagician proudly.
"Are there any precious stones in it?" asked Milo excitedly.
"Precious stones!" he roared,
even louder than before, and then he leaned over toward Milo and whispered softly,
"By the 8,247,312 threads in my robe, I'll say there are. Look here."
He reached into one of the carts and pulled out a small object, which he polished vigorously on his robe. When he held it up to the light, it sparkled brightly. "But that's a 5, objected Milo, for that was certainly what it was.
"Exactly," agreed the mathemagician. "As valuable a jewel as you'll find anywhere. Look at some of the others."
He scooped up a great handful of stones and poured them into Milo's arms. They included all the numbers from 1 to 9, and even an assortment of zeros.
"We dig them and polish them right here," volunteered the dodecahedron, pointing to a group of workers busily employed at the buffing wheels. "And then we send them all over the world. Marvelous, aren't they?"
"They are exceptional," said Tok, who had a special fondness for numbers.
"So that's where they come from," said Milo, looking in awe at the glittering collection of numbers. He returned them to the dodecahedron as carefully as possible, but, as he did, one dropped to the floor with a smash and broke in two. The humbug winced, and Milo looked terribly concerned.
"Oh, don't worry about that," said the mathemagician as he scooped up the pieces. "We use the broken ones for fractions." "Haven't you any diamonds or emeralds or rubies?" asked the bug irritably, for he was quite disappointed in what he'd seen so far. "Yes, indeed," the mathemagician replied, leading them to the rear of the cave. "Right this way."
There, piled into enormous mounds that reached almost to the ceiling, were not only diamonds and emeralds and rubies, but also sapphires, amethysts, topazes, moonstones, and garnets. It was the most amazing mass of wealth that any of them had ever seen.
"They're such a terrible nuisance," sighed the mathemagician, "and no one can think of what to do with them. So we just keep digging them up and throwing them out. Now," he said, taking a silver whistle from his pocket and blowing it loudly, "let's have some lunch."
And for the first time in his life, the astonished bug couldn't think of a thing to say. Chapter 15. This Way to Infinity. Into the cavern rushed 8 of the strongest miners, carrying an immense cauldron which bubbled and sizzled and sent great clouds of savory steam spiraling slowly to the ceiling. A sweet yet pungent aroma hung in the air and drifted easily from one anxious nose to the other, stopping only long enough to make several mouths water and a few stomachs growl. Milo, Tok, and the humbug watched eagerly as the rest of the workers put down their tools and gathered around the big pot to help themselves.
"Perhaps you'd care for something to eat,"
said the mathemagician, offering each of them a heaping bowlful.
"Yes, sir," said Milo, who was beside himself with hunger.
"Thank you," added Tok.
The humbug made no reply, for he was already too busy eating, and in a moment the three of them had finished absolutely everything they'd been given.
"Please have another portion," said the mathematician,
filling their bowls once more. And as quickly as they'd finished the first one, the second was emptied too.
"Don't stop now,"
he insisted, serving them again, and again, and again, and again, and again. "How very strange," thought Milo, as he finished his seventh helping. "Each one I eat makes me a little hungrier than the one before."
"Do have some more," suggested the mathematician,
and they continued to eat just as fast as he filled the plates. After Milo had eaten 9 portions, Tok 11, and the humbug, without once stopping to look up, 23, the mathematician blew his whistle for a second time, and immediately the pot was removed, and the miners returned to work.
"Oh!"
gasped the bug, suddenly realizing that he was 23 times hungrier than when he started.
"I think I'm starving!"
"Me too," complained Milo, whose stomach felt as empty as he could ever remember. "And I eat so much!"
"Yes, it was delicious, wasn't it?"
agreed the pleased dodecahedron, wiping the gravy from several of his mouths.
"It's the specialty of the kingdom. Subtraction, stew."
"I have more of an appetite than when I began,"
said Tok, leaning weakly against one of the larger rocks.
"Certainly," replied the mathematician. "What did you expect? The more you eat, the hungrier you get. Everyone knows that."
"They do," said Milo doubtfully. "Then how do you ever get enough?"
"Enough?" he said impatiently. "Here in Digitopolis, we have our meals when we're full and eat until we're hungry. That way, when you don't have anything at all, you have more than enough. It's a very economical system. You must have been quite stuffed to have eaten so much."
"It's completely logical," explained the dodecahedron. "The more you want, the less you get. And the less you get, the more you have. Simple arithmetic, that's all. Suppose you had something and added something to it. What would that make?"
"More," said Milo quickly.
"Quite correct," he nodded. "Now, suppose you had something and added nothing to it. What would you have?"
"The same," he answered again, without much conviction.
"Splendid," cried the dodecahedron. "And suppose you had something and added less than nothing to it. What would you have then?"
"Famine!"
roared the anguished humbug, who suddenly realized that that was exactly what he'd eaten 23 bowls of.
"It's not as bad as all that," said the dodecahedron from his most sympathetic face. "In a few hours you'll be nice and full again, just in time for dinner."
"Oh dear," said Milo sadly and softly. "I only eat when I'm hungry."
"What a curious idea," said the mathematician,
raising his staff over his head and scrubbing the rubber end back and forth several times on the ceiling.
"The next thing you'll have us believe is that you only sleep when you're tired."
And by the time he'd finished the sentence, the cavern, the miners, and the dodecahedron had vanished, leaving just the four of them standing in the mathematician's workshop.
"I often find," he casually explained to his dazed visitors, "that the best way to get from one place to another is to erase everything and begin again. Please make yourself at home."
"Do you always travel that way?" asked Milo, as he glanced curiously at the strange circular room, whose 16 tiny arched windows corresponded exactly to the 16 points of the compass. Around the entire circumference were numbers from 0 to 360, marking the degrees of the circle, and on the floor, walls, tables, chairs, desks, cabinets, and ceiling, were labels showing their heights, widths, depths, and distances to and from each other. To one side was a gigantic notepad set on an artist's easel, and from hooks and strings hung a collection of scales, rulers, measures, weights, tapes, and all sorts of other devices for measuring any number of things in every possible way.
"No, indeed," replied the mathematician,
and this time he raised the sharpened end of his staff, drew a thin straight line in the air, and then walked gracefully across it from one side of the room to the other.
"Most of the time I take the shortest distance between any 2 points. And of course, when I should be in several places at once,"
he remarked, writing 7 times 1 = 7 carefully on the notepad,
"I simply multiply."
Suddenly there were 7 mathematicians standing side by side, and each one looked exactly like the other.
"How did you do that?" gasped Milo.
"There's nothing to it,"
they all said in chorus.
"If you have a magic staff..."
Then 6 of them cancelled themselves out and simply disappeared.
"But it's only a big pencil,"
the humbug objected, tapping at it with his cane.
"True enough," agreed the mathematician. "But once you learn to use it, there's no end to what you can do."
"Can you make things disappear?" asked Milo excitedly.
"Why, certainly," he said, striding over to the easel. "Just step a little closer and watch carefully."
After demonstrating that there was nothing up his sleeves, in his hat, or behind his back, he wrote quickly, 4 + 9 - 2 × 16 + 1 / 3 × 6 - 67 + 8 × 2 - 3 + 26 - 1 / 34 + 3 / 7 + 2 - 5 = Then he looked up expectantly.
17!
Shouted the bug, who always managed to be first with the wrong answer. It all comes to zero, corrected Milo.
Precisely, said the mathematician, making a very theatrical bow, and the entire line of numbers vanished before their eyes. Now, is there anything else you'd like to see?
Yes, please, said Milo. Can you show me the biggest number there is?
I'd be delighted, he replied, opening one of the closet doors. We keep it right here. It took 4 miners just to dig it out.
Inside was the biggest 3 Milo had ever seen. It was fully twice as high as the mathematician.
No, that's not what I mean, objected Milo. Can you show me the longest number there is?
Surely, said the mathematician, opening another door. Here it is. It took 3 carts to carry it here.
Inside the closet was the longest 8 imaginable. It was just about as wide as the 3 was high.
No, that's not what I mean either, said Milo, looking helplessly at Talk.
I think what you would like to see, said the dog, scratching himself just under 4:30, is the number of greatest possible magnitude.
Well, why didn't you just say so?
Said the mathematician, who was busily measuring the edge of a raindrop.
What's the greatest number you can think of?
9,999,999,999,999,
recited Milo breathlessly.
Very good, said the mathematician. Now add one to it. Now add one again, he repeated when Milo had added the previous one. Now add one again. 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 Now add...
But when can I stop? Pleaded Milo.
Never, said the mathematician with a little smile, for the number you want is always at least 1 more than the number you've got, and it's so large that if you started saying it yesterday, you wouldn't finish tomorrow. Where could you ever find a number so big? Scoffed the humbug. In the same place they have the smallest number there is, he answered helpfully. And you know what that is?
Certainly, said the bug, suddenly remembering something to do at the other end of the room.
1/1,000,000th?
Asked Milo, trying to think of the smallest fraction possible.
Almost, said the mathematician. Now divide it in half. Now divide it in half again. 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 Now divide it.
Oh dear, shouted Milo, holding his hands to his ears. Doesn't that ever stop either?
How can it, said the mathematician, when you can always take half of whatever you have left until it's so small that if you started to say it right now, you'd finish even before you began.
Where could you keep anything so tiny? Milo asked, trying very hard to imagine such a thing.
The mathematician stopped what he was doing and explained simply,
Why, in a box that's so small you can't see it, and that's kept in a drawer that's so small you can't see it, in a dresser that's so small you can't see it, in a house that's so small you can't see it, on a street that's so small you can't see it, in a city that's so small you can't see it, which is part of a country that's so small you can't see it, in a world so small that you can't see it.
Then he sat down, found himself with a handkerchief, and continued,
And of course we keep the whole thing in another box that's so small you can't see it, and if you follow me, I'll show you where to find it.
They walked to one of the small windows, and there, tied to the sill, was one end of a line that stretched along the ground and into the distance until completely out of sight.
Just follow that line forever, said the mathematician, and when you reach the end, turn left. There you'll find the land of infinity, where the tallest, the shortest, the biggest, the smallest, the most, and the least of everything are kept.
I really don't have that much time, said Milo anxiously. Isn't there a quicker way?
Well, you might try this flight of stairs, he suggested, opening another door and pointing up. It goes there, too.
Milo bounded across the room and started up the stairs 2 at a time.
Wait for me, please, he shouted to Tok and the humbug. I'll just be gone a few minutes.
Woo, things are getting interesting for Milo. Is he going to ever get to the end of the flight of stairs? I kind of wonder, but definitely the dodecahedron. That was an interesting voice to try and... I really wanted to get across that each voice was a different face of the dodecahedron. Hopefully it worked for you. I thought it was amazing, but as we've previously established, I do thoroughly enjoy the sound of my own voice. That'll do it for this week. I think a baby might be stirring a little bit, and he's not supposed to bake without supervision. Hey, rimshot. So I'm going to go and see to my son. But, hey, own the stage that you're on, whatever stage that is. And thanks for listening. We'll see you here in a bit.